You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're dreading the impending end of our catchphrase. It's 2018. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you can't yet figure out how to explain 2019, then you belong here in the midside, and your friends probably do too. So why don't you tell them about us, okay? Okay! Joining me this trip, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
I think we have to have at least like a 60-second Belichick your premises here, where we talk about what just happened. More so, I think, as group therapy, just for you and me, than for the listeners. But, for anyone who is unaware, the Patriots just lost against the Dolphins in the most improbable 69-yard lateral play at the end of a game, maybe in history.
So, no, that's not... Did you ever look up the Music City Miracle?
I did. This one feels a little more improbable than that one.
Look, dude, first of all, whenever you miss an extra point like that at the beginning of the game, it reminds me of the AFC Championship game in Denver. Remember, we missed that extra point, and then we had to go for two at the end of the game and missed it and lost. Yeah. The second we missed that extra point out on the first touchdown, I was like, that's going to come back to haunt us. And then also, I swear to God, I thought this to myself beforehand, where they're like, Gronkowski going back to the goal line for the Hail Mary play. And in my head, I went, if that dude has to make a game-saving tackle, he's going to miss it. And then what happened?
He couldn't even get over to the sideline in time.
He tripped. I've been watching the game too long that I know all the possible iterations, and I know we don't win in Miami. It just weird shit happens in Miami. And at some point, putting Gronk on the Hail Mary team was going to come back to bite us in the ass, and this was the most likely time. So that's why my brain went there. I've just seen watch football for so long on such an entry level, you've seen all the possible iterations.
Yes, well, this was an iteration that I didn't want to see, didn't need to see, and in fact, I'm offended by having seen.
You're offended.
Well, if everyone else can be, why can't I be?
That's fair. I'm just a little bit sad. We know Kansas City now is going to be the number one seed in the AFC. Although they look imminently beatable, I don't think they'll win in the playoffs. I think whoever the number two seed is could still host the AFC Championship game because Kansas City has a high likelihood of being upset in the divisional round. But yeah. Even though we're still in the running for the number two seed because Houston lost and Pittsburgh has four losses and we play them next week and we have the tiebreaker over Houston, it still feels like we just lost our entire season because while we were winning that game, Kansas City was losing. Then we improbably lost and Kansas City improbably came back and won. It's just the series of events that happened were insane.
One of those weeks, man. What's the cliched any given Sunday phrase?
Yes, that's exactly the cliched phrase, and that it also involves a movie starring Jamie Foxx.
And Al Pacino.
Hoo-ah! Mm-hmm. All right, I don't think we should spend any more emotional energy on this. What do you think?
That sounds about right.
And let's talk about some other things that other people were spending emotional energy on that they shouldn't have, which is basically sums up the internet, I think. It's 2018, and it's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
Thanks so much to all of you listeners, and if you want to help us out even more, you can check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/themidside, where you can choose to give a couple bucks every time we produce this little bit of content for you. You can see that, that even when a third co-host cannot make it to the show, we soldier on.
Because he's on paternity leave.
He's on paternity leave. William is pregnant, everyone. breaking the news here and now. But if you like the show, you can choose to donate on patreon.com/midside, where you also get exclusive Patreon-only content and Patreon-exclusive chat rooms in our Discord channel. So, on to the news. Slate this week, delving deep to find something negative to say about H.W. Bush's death, ran an article called "Don't Spend Your Emotional Energy on Sully H.W. Bush." Subheadline, he's a service dog who has been with the president for 6 months, not his lifelong companion. So on Sunday night, George H.W. Bush, his spokesman, Jim McGrath, posted a Twitter photo depicting a golden Labrador named Sully resting in front of the former president's casket. The caption read, "Mission complete. All much sad." Within hours, Sully the dog had become a bona fide celebrity, and the tweet was retweeted 61,000 times and counting. C-SPAN covered it, lots of other places wrote articles, etc. And Slate even concedes there's nothing wrong with applying sentimentality when it comes to family pets reacting to their owners' deaths. But here's where they start to go off the rails a little bit. But Sully is not a lifelong Bush family pet, letting go of the only master he has known. He is an employee who has served for less than 6 months. Sully's Instagram account, which has 147,000 followers, doesn't that make you feel sad, Justin, has been active since late June. That's when he, i.e. the dog, posted a photograph with a sign reading, "Walker's Point, Here I Come," referring to the location of the Bush family compound in Kennebunkport, Maine. Sully arrived there over the summer to help the former president, who used a wheelchair because of symptoms of Parkinson's disease, with tasks such as opening doors and picking up objects. So, Justin, should you stop spending so much emotional energy on the Bush dog?
I didn't spend any emotional energy on the Bush dog. In fact, my girlfriend sent me that picture you're referring to on Instagram or whatever it was about, we don't deserve dogs or whatever. Did you see that?
Yes, I've seen that meme going around, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sensing that you really don't like this article, which is interesting because I'm all for this article.
Tension. Bum, bum, bum. Okay, so, why, Justin, are you all for this article?
Oh, I was hoping you would say why you were against this article, since you all subliminally put that in there. But no, I mean, I think this whole thing of building up the dog as a big deal is, you know, a weird misplacement of the fact that we just lost a president, whether you liked him or not. I mean, he wasn't spectacular, right? Nobody really loves Bush 41, right? Is Bush 41 anyone's favorite or least favorite president? I think all you can say about George 41 is Bush 41 is he was a president, I think. So
he's going to be remembered up there with the likes of Millard Fillmore and Martin Van Buren.
So. Right. And in today's soundbite era, it will always be read my lips, no new taxes, right? That's all we're going to take away from and Dan Quayle. Those are the three things, right? So it's just the fact that we lost a president and then we're here, we're focusing on the dog who isn't even a part of the family or anything. He literally is an employee. Like, what about all the other employees sitting there who are human beings? What about the human beings who are sitting there being loyal?
I get it.
There's just something with me where you're good valuing point. Animals there, more than loyal. You're valuing humans.
Yes. I get all that. I don't have a problem with your criticism of any of that. My problem is this. One, this was a tweet. Who cares? It was a tweet. People find tweets annoying or delightful or interesting, insightful, boring, sexy, whatever, all the time. Then someone decided to write an entire opinion piece about this tweet. Not, you know, for some larger cultural commentary, but so they could have something to say, in my mind, about something negative to say about this dead president, essentially. Don't spend emotional energy on Sully H.W. Bush. What is emotion? What does that even mean? Don't spend your emotional energy. It's a picture, and you look at it, and for 1 second you go, aw, and then you move on with your life. Is that going to drain someone? Has that person reached peak emotional energy and now they're downhill for the rest of their lives because they're at an emotional energy deficit because they looked at a picture of a dog?
Well, I don't know, Daniel. In our narcissistic society, we don't feel compassion very often. So if you say aw to a picture of a dog, I think that uses up most people's compassion reserves for the day.
Could be, maybe the week. Point here being, so you don't like the president, you don't like Republicans, whatever it is, just, you know, take 10 seconds out of your day to think, should I really write this piece for Slate? And the answer is almost universally going to be no. Also, I should never write for Slate.
I mean, what you're talking about is really a manifestation of the 24-hour social media news cycle where everyone is just trying to find quote-unquote hot takes, which, by the way, is one of the phrases I hate the most in the world. Oh, look at this hot take. So you have an opinion on something now. It's just a hot take because everyone's just looking for something to say immediately to draw attention to their social media channels over whatever just happened. That's all it is. It used to be.
Do you think?
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it used to be live tweeting, and everyone wanted the live tweet things. Now, everyone just wants to have the immediate hot take of all the clicks going to their site.
Two things. One, do you think that hot take has a legitimate use? To me, I do agree that the term hot take is now overly used and should maybe go the way of the dodo, which, as Adam Kroll has pointed out, is a phrase that has, in fact, gone the way of the dodo. But to me, the legitimate use is someone who wants to take a controversial opinion, even though they clearly don't hold that opinion, in order to gain attention to themselves.
But here's the problem, Daniel. And we'll go into slang a little bit more in the life
and
of
I have
the
a second thing.
Yeah,
remind me that I have a second thing.
Yeah, okay. You have a second thing. That's great. Nobody cares.
You're gonna.
No, here's the thing. It's like the term basic, right? The term basic is a valid concept. Like, we need to know, like, this is Midsider Katrina is one of her best arguments she ever made to me. The term basic is valid because we need to know what basic is to know what good is. You know, it's a comparative thing. But the problem is the people who call people basic the most are basic. So the term has lost all usefulness because it's only being used to self-identify as basically. It's the same thing with hot takes. It is now a hot take to call somebody else's opinion a hot take.
Oh, it's so meta. So meta. I hate the internet. So this is my second point, which is more so a business idea for anyone who has a few million dollars and looking to invest in something that will make billions, which is, I don't know if I brought this up before, but I think we legitimately could have a business simply called Not First News. And our tagline will be never first, always accurate, or something like that. Never first, always right, or however you want to phrase it. The whole point being, we will not do breaking news. We will not do hot takes. We will do slow, careful, thorough analysis and reporting. We may even be 48 hours behind the other news, but we'll never get a fact wrong.
48 hours? Daniel, I have an idea for this business. What if every morning this product was delivered to your doorstep and you read it over breakfast?
Do you mean like on a Kindle?
No, I mean like on like actual, what's it called when you like take trees and you like make them really thin? What's that called?
Money?
Basically, because or death to the environment, I think it's called. No.
Yeah.
I actually yearn for the days in high school. I used to read the sports section every morning in the newspaper. I would read the scores and everything. That's how I would know the players. That's how I would know what they were doing. That's how I learned baseball scoring, right? Because you can read all that stuff in the newspaper. And it's also less of a time suck because when's the time you're going to read the news? In the morning. It's not like I'm looking at my phone and it's like, what time? Didn't Bush 41 die at like 9:30 at night or something?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Right, but it popped up on the phone. Like, you almost feel like you're obligated to be connected to know what's going on. Because otherwise, if you're walking down the street and some random person's like, did you hear that Bush 41 died? And you're like, what? Bush 41 died? You feel like a fucking retard.
You get serious FOMO.
To me, it's not FOMO. To me, it's like, as an educated person, as a worldly person, you're supposed to know what's going on in the world. So it's ironic, right? If you are living your own life and you don't know what's going on in the world, you're considered narcissistic, even though it's not possible to stay connected 24/7. even though what's more narcissistic is being connected 24/7 to be able to prove to people you're worldly. It's weirdly, we're living in this ironic time. Like, it's the whole basic hot take thing. It's, we're living in an ironic time where the people who don't engage in this are the better people, but they're seen as the worst people.
Yeah. It's a weird sort of like power trip, I think, that people get when they can tell someone something they don't know, when they can break them news. Like, for that split second, you have this sort of weird power over them. And that's not a healthy way to go about life. A more healthy way to go about life is to be perfectly fine with the words "I do not know." So, my point with my not first news, though, Justin, is not that we would even be like newspapers, since they also have hard print deadlines and still want to be first to things. The entire business model would be, we will never break news. We will just report it accurately.
Yeah, and just on a website.
Yes, of course.
I was just saying that I think if you actually just took a day to make news and like make a newspaper and also created that schedule for people where they know when the release is going to be, that it's going to create a healthier product for you and a healthier product for them, because they're going to have the dependent schedule. And it's different nowadays. I agree with you back then that it that had the same pressure as social media, where you had to be first, like an internet commenter. But nowadays, because that is a defined time constraint that is not necessary, I think it would create a different quality than even newspapers had back in the day.
Well, perhaps. So if anyone wants to invest, I'm open to checks of six figures or higher. Well, the Oscars are concerned about their product and the quality of it. That's why they have now, I don't know if they've disinvited, but potential host Kevin Hart has now stepped down from hosting the Oscars after a very quick stint of actually hosting the
Oscars. He didn't step down very far, right?
You're making a short joke?
It's okay. We're both short. We can say it to each other.
It's not a stretch for you.
Ah,
a short joke.
Ah.
On Wednesday, the Academy Awards announced the comedian Kevin Hart as the host of this year's broadcast. Apparently, he wasn't the first person asked, though. The Hollywood Reporter has just run a piece titled "Why Oscar Host Has Become the Least Wanted Job in Hollywood," noting the A-list talents Oprah Winfrey and Tina Fey had reportedly passed. Hart, in contrast, indicated publicly that this was a dream gig. On Instagram, he said that he was, quote, "blown away simply because this has been a goal on my list for a long time," end quote. But within hours, the internet unearthed a number of homophobic tweets from Hart's past, including one now deleted from 2011, quote, "Yo, if my son comes home and tries to play with my daughter's dollhouse, I'm going to break it over his head and say in my voice, stop, that's gay," end quote.
Can I just point something out? We're upset about the fact that he doesn't want his kid to be gay when he literally just joked about child abuse. Isn't that worse?
Yes, a little bit. Another tweet described a Twitter user's photo as, quote, "a gay billboard for AIDS," end quote. There were sprinklings of gay by association quotes and no homo and some other things throughout his feed. The journalist Benjamin Lee of The Guardian shared a routine from Hart's 2010 comedy special, Seriously Funny, in which he says, quote, "One of my biggest fears is my son growing up and being gay. That's a fear. Keep in mind, I'm not homophobic. Be happy. Do what you want to do. But me, as a heterosexual male, if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will," end quote. He goes on to describe his son Hendrick's possible homosexual tendencies, to which his fatherly response is, quote, "stop, that's gay," end quote. Justin, do you think that he's trying to be funny, or do you think that he has some genuine homophobia? Follow-up question, should that prevent him from hosting the Oscars?
You just want to hear the catchphrase, don't you?
I do. Hit that catchphrase.
False dichotomy, bro.
There
the
it
best
is.
Comedy
boom, boom.
Is born of real thoughts and real feelings and real experiences. I believe he doesn't want his son to be gay. Also, controversial statement, I don't think it's wrong for him to say he has a preference, right? It's the same thing. Hold on, internet. Hold on, okay? It's the same thing as when you get a woman pregnant and you go, you know, I'd prefer I had a son than a daughter, or I'd prefer I had a daughter than a son. You can have a preference. That's natural. It is normal to have a preference. It is healthy to acknowledge it, but it's also healthy that when a person individuates and becomes who he or she is, or Z is, or they are, whatever fucking pronoun they want to use, as an individual, you respect that and love them for who they are. It doesn't mean you love them less, but it means if you had to choose, you would choose that. For instance, if I had to choose, I would like every season of the Patriots to end in a Super Bowl championship. But I love
totally
every team the same.
Unequivocally the same.
It's totally the same. I mean, do you think I don't watch the games and I go, stop that, that's dumb? Stop that, that's retarded? The only reason I don't say stop Ooh. That, that's gay in polite company is because that's considered not polite anymore. What do you think people would say in the 90s? Oh, that's gay. I can't believe that happened. The end of that game that just happened, that's gay. That's what we would have said in the 90s, but we don't. You can have preferences, but when reality comes against what you fictionalized in your head, you always have to choose reality. And that's the problem when you start getting into these people who choose the fiction and then they try to do like conversion therapy and stuff. Now, the joke is that he's doing that when he's like, stop, that's gay. You know, if his kid turned out to be gay, do you think he's going to turn around and say, stop, that's gay? Well, he might, because it's funny when your friends are the gay guy and you get along with them really well and you point out the shit he does that's gay. And he just laughs. He's like, yeah, of course it's gay. I'm gay. It's like saying A is A over and over again. Because they're so, you know what I mean? That they're so self-assured.
Objectivist humor.
Oh, okay, yes, objectivist humor. And as for the second question, no, he should not be kicked off of the Oscars. But what do you expect? They're social justice Oscars. I mean, nobody's really fit to host the Oscars based upon their standards. You can always dig up something here. That's the greater problem here. When do we stop doing this? When do we stop digging into someone's past? Oh, I'll tell you when we stop. When the person is identified as good, as an ally, as on our side. They don't like Kevin Hart because he appeals to the masses. He appeals to the common man, especially the common black man. And that's why they don't like him. They need people who are on their side in this social justice crusade. And he is not. And that is what this really is. This is a tool they use because people buy into it and people let them do it. This is a tool they use to keep their group as the in-group. And Kevin Hart was just a victim of this. And you know who pointed this out very well? Is Nick Cannon. I love the fact that Nick Cannon went through and he found homophobic tweets from Amy Schumer, Chelsea Handler, Sarah Silverman, where they basically all use the fag word. They all called people fags and said, you know, haha, fag. And he was like, why is no one offended at this? Why are they allowed to continue to do things? Although I don't think Chelsea Handler has a career right now. But you get the point. He's pointing out the hypocrisy. And I enjoy that. I don't enjoy the fact that he's doing it collectivistically because it's another black male comedian it happened to. But he's 100% right, and I find it deliciously hilarious.
Well, I think the Oscars will only be complete when they stop inviting celebrities at all to host and instead invite, black, transgender, lesbian, quadriplegic, feminist professors to host. And they, in fact, don't give out awards, but simply televise a 2.5-hour lecture on cisgendered, heteronormative, Eurocentric oppression in history, with a Marxist angle, of course. Then I think Oscars will be complete, and we can finally have someone who can host without controversy. That's the goal, I think. So
Oscars so trite.
Oh, there you go. Hashtag Oscars so trite. Get that trending. Well, this apparently seems to be a little bit of a theme in the past few days, as the sports-related folks will know that Kyler Murray, who is the Oklahoma quarterback, just won the Heisman Trophy, and within hours, homophobic tweets surfaced, and he has had to apologize. I doubt his trophy will be taken away, but apparently when he was 14 or 15, and on Twitter, he would respond to his friends and call them queer in many different settings, and that is, I guess, homophobic. So,
technically queer doesn't even mean gay. I mean, he could just be calling them odd.
True. I doubt it, but true. Technically speaking.
And I just want to preemptively defend myself. Whenever you see no homo, it's a typo. I meant no Romo, because I didn't want anyone to think I was trying to idolize Tony Romo.
That would be a funny way of replacing that. Yeah. That sort of reminds me of PETA. You stop using the anti-animal language. Did you read that story?
Yep.
Where, like, for instance, instead of using...
bring home the bacon.
What did they want for that one? I don't remember. But I remember
the... Kevin Bacon? I don't know.
That's good. I like that. I remember instead of killing two birds with one stone, they wanted you to say feeding two birds with one scone. Which sounds like the best satire you've ever read.
It's like someone in France is sitting around figuring out how to piss off the rest of the world.
That's right. Instead of beating a dead horse, they wanted you to say feeding a fed horse.
Which also, by the way, might lead to killing that horse, because overfeeding animals can kill them. BTW.
Feeding bird scones could kill them. You're not supposed to feed them sugary scones. That's horrible. Why would you do that to birds? It's awful.
Birds are people, too.
That's right.
They deserve your emotional energy over Sully.
Yes, they do.
And I mean both Sullys, the fucking dog and the airplane pilot.
Airport pilot. Thank you. All right. So on to Canada.
It's too crashy.
On to Canada. I've moved on to Canada. Parents are angry and call for the removal of an offensive sign near a school. This is what's going on in Canada.
Doesn't this sound like a hardtimes.net article?
It does, but this is totally woke. Distraught parents have called for an apology and the removal of a sign hung on a fence near a school in Winnipeg. Moms and dads have failed to see the funny side of the notice, which reads, "This is not a drop-off zone. Children left here will be eaten." Hung by a neighboring business. The word children was taped over when CTV News visited the site. Parent Jems Dale, this person's name is Jems, G-E-M-S, said, quote, "It kind of shook me to think that an adult put that sign there." They continued, "Putting a piece of tape on it is not going to do anything. We need to take the sign down and get rid of it, and then apologize." A business beside Marion School posted the warning to deter parents from entering the parking lot. Dale said the attempt was unacceptable. Quote, "We'd expect this behavior from children, but we would definitely not take this from an adult. Are we going to find this sign offensive or just slough it off and say, oh, that's okay?" So, Justin, are we going to find this sign offensive or just slough it off and say, oh, that's okay?
You just want to hear the catchphrase, don't you?
Hit it!
No, we're definitely just going to slough this one off as okay. Because, Jems, I got a breaking news story for you, Jems. Water. Wet. No, Jems, this is what I have to tell you about the reality is. You say putting tape over the word children isn't going to do anything. Well, Jems, if someone's actually going to eat children, taking the sign down isn't going to do anything either.
If it's a warning, you should be thanking them. If children are actually being eaten there, but no one had warned you beforehand, then your children were in more danger than they are now.
This is just another example of a question of where is our culture? What is our culture? What can we be anymore? Because I always remember growing up, going to places all over the country when we traveled and seeing signs like this. Now, I didn't take these signs seriously because I didn't think they were particularly funny or witty. I mean, this is pretty like lowbrow midwit humor, but they're everywhere. And I was trying to think of like examples of signs like this. And thankfully, Midsider Adam, who submitted this story, submitted a sign that he saw in August at a restaurant. And the sign was, "Warning, children left unattended will be sold to the circus."
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
I expect that behavior from children, but not from restaurant owners.
And the circus.
This is ludicrous. Yeah. The owner of this shop, by the way, said that after years of attempts to get parents not to drop their kid off in his private parking lot, he decided to put this sign up with a little bit of humor to see if it would get people's attention, so they'd stop dropping kids off in his private parking lot. This is a thing of self-reflection that the parents are not getting here, which is they are doing something wrong. The private property owner is trying to, in a lighthearted, humorous way, discourage them from doing something wrong. So why don't they introspect a little bit instead of externalize everything and have a GD sense of humor about life and not drop their kids off in a private parking lot?
Well, this is the narcissism. I mean, if you didn't tell me any differently, I would think this is a California story, because this is one of my hardest things in life right now, Daniel. And maybe this could be a Life on the Midside segment, but we're talking about it now. I know we're all big about, like, not getting offended in the midside, but this shit offends me, okay? It offends me because you are the one doing something wrong. You are objectively doing something wrong. You are being a dick. You are being a fag, okay?
Careful. We're going to get canceled.
No Romo. No, mid-side, you are being so a white jerk. You are, yeah, the one being a jerk by, you think someone else's private property is just for you to fucking use however you want. And that person tries to fight back against you in a way that isn't going to cause extreme amount of conflict. Like, he didn't do what I would do. He didn't do what your wife would do, which is get in the fucking parking lot while you're dropping your kids off there and say, get your fucking kids out of my parking lot.
Yep.
That's what we would fucking do. And then it would be a big, yep, hoopla. The police would come. Someone would try and fight me. And I would be like, why am I not punching people right now? All right, I don't want to go to jail. And I believe in the non-initiation of force. All of that shit would happen. This guy's actually trying to do it in a very, I don't know, Canadian way, right? Because you guys are all super polite up in Canada. And you're still offended by it because you're so up your own ass. And I don't know. I don't know how to not be offended by this kind of behavior. I find this incredibly offensive. I find it really offensive when you're the one who does something wrong, and when someone calls you out on it, you get offended at being called out on it.
Yes. Yes. They can accept anything except the naming of reality.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't get offended, right, by your original sloth and stupidity. Like, okay, that you're just a fucking basic person who makes hot takes. That's fine. Like, you want to be that asshole, be that hassle. But when you get called out on it, fucking own that shit and just deal with it. Be like, ah, fuck, they caught me. I'm going to have to do it the hard way now.
Well, Gemsdale sounds like a real diamond. So, all right, moving on. A professor, of course. Shouldn't even have to start stories like that. You should just assume it's professor. Says that God wrongfully impregnated a teenage Virgin Mary without her consent. Yes, a Minnesota psychology professor caught the attention of conservative pundits this week after tweeting that God impregnated the Virgin Mary without consent. Eric Sprankle, an associate professor at the Minnesota State University, angered Fox News host Tucker Carlson, who you would not like when he's angry, and guest commentator Mark Stein with his Monday comments. He wrote, quote, "The virgin birth story is about an all-knowing, all-powerful deity impregnating a human teen. There is no definition of consent that would include that scenario. Happy holidays." He later added, quote, "The biblical God regularly punished disobedience. The power difference, deity versus mortal, and the potential for violence for saying no negates her yes. To put someone in this position is an unethical abuse of power at best and grossly predatory at worst." Justin, what say you? Does the professor have a point?
He has a point if you completely ignore the definition of God. This is the entire problem of Christianity. It's done in another example. Trying to have free will with an all-knowing, all-powerful God. It's the same fucking thing. Of course he didn't have her consent. He doesn't have her consent to do anything. Did Adam have his consent to take his rib and make Eve?
Absolutely not.
Did any of us have his consent where he was like, well, I'm going to flood it, the earth and kill half of everything, or kill everything except the shit you put on an ark? What about when the fucking baby was cut in half?
Cut in half? I know that what was his name? Abraham was told to kill his son, Isaac. I don't think he did. Yeah, I don't really remember.
Okay, but, well, you get the point I'm making, right? Like, if you look at the Bible, the entire story is, and this is the thing, this is what really gets me going, because this is really a literary analysis issue. The entire story is about God testing people by doing things without their consent, but because he has greater knowledge than them, and asking them to accept it on faith. Faith with the idea of faith in, that he has greater knowledge and power than them. That's the entire story. And that's the story of the virgin birth, is that Mary and Joseph accept that God has given them this great honor of bearing his child, and they take the responsibility on faith. And that's why they're considered pious in the religion, in the Catholic Church. That's why they're raised up. And I'm sure in other Christianity, other sects of Christianity as well, that's why they're raised up, because they didn't question God. And they said, God, this is what you want. Then we trust your greatness. And now I'm angry because I'm just doing literary analysis and I sound like a fucking Christian.
You do sound a little bit Christian there, but let's be clear.
But that's the story, isn't it? I'm just analyzing the story objectively, am I not?
You are, in fact, objectively analyzing the story, yes.
Okay.
And what he's doing is a form of reductiveness that completely misses the point and, you know, would go to almost a literalist school of interpretation of literature, which would make no sense whatsoever.
You mean a naturalistic approach to the Bible?
Yes, indeed.
Wait, the Bible's just a series of metaphors to teach people how to live life based on Christian morals?
What? Since when? Oh, forever. Yes. So here's the thing. I'm an atheist. Pretty sure you're an atheist. We're both atheists.
The atheists... only God I believe in wears number 12 and plays for the Patriots. And he will be wrathful and vengeful this week.
I hope he will. I hope he takes this setback with the Dolphins right into Heinz Field and puts up a 50 burger on the Pittsburgh Steelers. So, okay, enough of that. My point is, I'm an atheist, you're an atheist. Why is it that I often find other atheists, mostly who are non-objectivists, completely insufferable? They're just totally insufferable. They have not thought through anything. They have no actual expertise in ideas or philosophy. They're often emotionless, garbage, douche human beings. What is it with it? If you don't have theism, which I don't think you should, you do need a moral compass of some sort. You do need a philosophy of some sort. And just being someone who goes around destroying values is not that. You cannot define yourself by the absence of a belief. All it is an absence. That's it. You have to have a positive belief to be able to move forward with your life. And so many atheists, and it sounds like this professor is the same way, don't have that. They get their self-esteem from total destruction, and that is it. And that, to me, is so insufferable compared to your everyday average Christian, who I would almost certainly rather hang out with.
Because they don't see an alternative. I know you're posing this question. Maybe you're doing it because you...
It's not a question. Okay. It's a rant disguised as a question.
Okay, well, maybe you didn't know I had the answer, but I have the answer to your rant. I can answer this quandary for you.
Please do.
It's the same thing with people who misunderstand objectivism. Mm. People think if you take God out of the equation, there is no higher power. And I use that phrase very intentionally because... the person I heard put this best ever was Dr. Drew, where somebody called into the Adam and Drew show and said, how as an atheist can I do the 12-step program? Because I don't believe in a higher power. And Drew said, stop, wait a minute. Higher power doesn't mean God. Higher power just means there are forces outside of our control. And you have to accept that in order to go through the 12 steps. And the reason you have to accept that is you have to accept that to be rational and healthy in reality. These people like this professor, they get rid of God and then they think, oh, well, I'm the highest power. And they get enjoyment from the sense of destruction because that proves to them that they have power over the world and over other people and over reality. That's why they, you know, engage in relativism and social constructionism and all of that, because they believe they are the highest authority. That's what atheism is to people. This narcissistic belief that you are the world. And, you know, objectivists make this mistake too. where they don't have reality above all. Whereas me personally, I do believe in a higher power. There you go. Take that drop out there. I believe in a higher power. It's called reality. I can only control the shit in my control. Yes, I am upset that the Patriots lost, and it frustrates me because they should have won that game. Like, all they had to do was, like, fucking one person tackle one guy with the ball on that last play. But when I watched Gronkowski trip trying to go over to there, even though I saw it ahead of time and I said to myself, shit, if Gronk has to make a tackle on this play, we're fucked. And I said that to myself before the play in my head. And then I watch it play out. Part of the reason it's so frustrating and makes me so sad is I know it's outside of my control. And even though I know the Patriots were the better team today, and they're the more talented team than the Dolphins, for some reason they always fucking lose in Miami in December. I can't explain it. I can't explain why these things happen. They do, and it's outside of my control. Now, rather than going out there and trying to shit all over the Dolphins fans, who then are now enjoying this win, when the Dolphins fan, as I left Hooters today, said, oh, man, sorry. And I go, eh, it happens. And he goes, I'm a Dolphins fan. You know what I said to him? I just said, you shouldn't be talking to me right now. Because his only purpose of talking to me was to be destructive. And I don't want to talk to him. I want to let him go over there, enjoy what just happened, and enjoy your Super Bowl win. Enjoy all of that. I can't control any of that, though. So I believe in that higher power. I believe that there is power beyond me that I have no say in. I can't. It's called, I call it reality.
Yes. To wrap this up, I think in a nice little bow, did you know that Ayn Rand had a favorite prayer? Ayn Rand.
I did not know that.
Famous atheist had a favorite prayer, and it was this. It was the beginning of the Serenity Prayer, which is very famous. And it goes a little something like this. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Which I think is very apropos for the end of this segment.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Let's talk about some other things that are pretty good. Moving on to the Hopeful Romantic with JML.
Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on.
The end of the year is upon us. In a couple episodes, we will be having our year-end wrap-up special where we give out our year-end rewards and we talk about the top news stories of the year. But that also means we need your help, Midsiders. If you go to the midside.com/awards, you can vote and nominate for all of the awards. The Narcissist of the Year, the Social Justice Warrior of the Year, the Romantic Manifestation of the Year, who made the best piece of romantic art in the past year. And there's also the Peak Farce Audience Award. So what was the most farcical story we covered this year? That award is solely voted on by you. So we need you, Midsiders. We need you to give us nominations because it's been a tough year. The Narcissist of the Year might be, we might pull a move from Time Magazine here and say you.
He's so meta.
You, except we'll say, except not Midsiders.
You asterisk.
You asterisk. Yeah, that's even better. Hashtag you too.
That's right. But not that one. You know.
Long story short, there's a lot that we don't know this year because of the higher power. No, there's a lot we don't know, and we need your help. So go to the midside.com/award, vote for the Peak Farce Award, and give us your nominees for all of the other awards. For the review this week, William has been bugging me to talk about DuckTales Season 2, and I finally caught up. Daniel and I have invested in Hulu Live, which I didn't know Hulu Live. You know, you can have a DVR as well, which I don't... Daniel, by the way, I don't know. Did you notice that the DVR is accidentally recording every, like, Celtics and Patriots and Clemson game?
So that's funny. When I was setting the thing up, it said, who are your favorite teams? And I picked all the Boston teams and Clemson, but I didn't know that meant it was going to record shit.
I did stuff. The same thing. So it must have been like, yeah. Wow, they really like these teams.
Funny.
So yeah, it's good recording times. All of them. But it also, I didn't realize this. You get more shows on Hulu with Hulu Live. All of DuckTales season 2 that's been released is already on Hulu Live. I thought I was going to have to DVR it. So I was able to just binge it. And I understand why William wants to review this show. I think season 2 is even better than season 1. And Daniel, I'm going to say something and I'm going to instantly convince you to watch it. Ready?
I am ready.
My summary of season 2 of DuckTales is the original DuckTales crossed with Gravity Falls.
I'm in.
That it's that good.
Done.
The reason it's good is I'm going to use some things William said here. There are strong relationship themes and the stories are interesting and more than just episodic. So there's an overarching narrative to this family of ducks and what's going on with them. And it's all building towards how it happened, what's going on with that. And it's delving into the past of all of the villains and adding this real depth to it. Now, I've done a little bit of research because I haven't read the original comics. But a lot of it is right out of the original comics. But then they're adding new things to it. Like they keep referencing Saint Canard and they had Don Carnage on last season. So there's references to other Disney afternoon shows too. And I know they've got plans for Darkwing Duck in this universe as well. So it's just really interesting the way that it's taking the 80s, everything that was good about the 80s show, but using the more serialized, in-depth storytelling that Gravity Falls really optimized. Also,
all right,
we have to acknowledge Scrooge isn't the villain. And that's wonderful. They celebrate that.
That was our primary concern when this show was relaunched, right? That yes. We thought it was going to go a little social justice-y.
And it didn't. The only sort of social justice-y thing is they made Gizmo Duck. My mind is blanking right now, but his alter ego, his secret identity, they made him voiced by Lin-Manuel Miranda, so they made him Hispanic. Which I don't know why you need to make ducks different races, but I mean, I guess you have a Scottish duck, so why can't you have a Hispanic duck, right?
Sure. Of course.
And they had they actually have an episode with I'm pretty sure they're supposed to be from Maine because they're like fishermen. It's a fisher boat. It's a fishing boat. And I'm pretty sure the accents of the people are from Maine, which was really funny for me. I was laughing the entire episode. So sure, like whatever, you can have an Hispanic duck. I don't care. But even they did a Christmas episode this year and they played up the whole idea that he is Scrooge. Because remember, if you ever watched Mickey Mouse's Christmas Carol, Scrooge actually plays Scrooge in that. And in the episode of DuckTales, they played up the idea where he was acting like he hated Christmas, but people found out he doesn't actually hate Christmas. And there was a line that like, oh yeah, people confuse him with that Scrooge all the time.
Well, I'm in. I don't have much time to watch TV, but I think I could convince my wife that we should start binging this instead of watching reruns of Bob's Burgers.
Oh yeah, it's a lot better than Bob's Burgers. Look, Bob's Burgers is great, but to me it lost a lot of steam. What do you think?
I find like every other episode now is worth it, basically. So it used to be every episode was excellent, like superbly done, and now meh, 1 and 2, 1 and 3.
Agreed. Moral of the story, you should watch DuckTales 2017. You shouldn't watch Bob's Burgers. Or watch them both. All right, we're going to talk about some trailers here. And as always, if you want to watch the trailers before we record, I put them up generally the weekend before the show is released. So if you go to themidside.com/podcast, you can watch the trailers before the show. You can watch them during the show. You can alternate.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Watership Down is the BBC One animated remake of the movie based on the book, which I've heard is a hell of a story about bunnies. This trailer, however, looks like a 90s video game. Am I wrong, Daniel? You're the animated connoisseur over here. But all I could see about this was, I was like, this looks like torture porn or something. It's just like, why are we watching rabbits fight each other in really bad graphics? Just because you can do something now because it's cheaper doesn't mean you should. Tackle.
Tackle.
Oy vey. Yeah, so Watership Down, the book, is sort of a depressing tale, but you can sort of get through it, and it has some interesting points and some good writing because you're just using your imagination, and sometimes you get lost and stop remembering that these are bunnies. When it's on screen and visualized in such a realistic style of animation, you can never get over the fact that they're bunnies, and it comes off as weird and shallow, and like they're fighting to the death at the end, and there's like a Braveheart scene, but they're bunnies. This, poorly if you were going to animate bunnies. This, poorly animated bunnies, if you were going to animate this, which I think you almost have to, I mean, you could do it stop motion maybe, but regardless, the point would be, it would have to be extraordinarily stylized in order to pull it off. It would have to be, you know, Kubo and the Two Strings type of stylization, or you know, I don't know if you saw the last Kung Fu Panda, Justin, but the flashback scenes that were done in this really flat Japanese animation style, for instance, something that dramatically stylized. Otherwise, these are just rabbits, and it's hard to get into it. I can't even imagine watching this full movie. I barely made it through the trailer. Tackle.
Tackle.
Speaking of stylization of animated movies or remakes of animated movies, live action remakes, I know you love The Jungle Book, and you know I had my problems with it. Have you, this? I guess we consider this a bonus trailer. Have you seen the trailer for the new Mowgli movie?
I have.
They showed it during football. As, did you see it during the game?
Yes, otherwise known as Jungle Book with one-third the budget.
Yeah. Okay, I'm glad you said that, because it says, like, in there, from visionary director Andy Serkis. And I was like, is his vision to make, like, a cheap ripoff of the Disney version of this?
Hey, that movie did really well. What could we do for $50 million less?
Exactly.
Yeah. It looks awful.
Visually, it looks terrible. I mean, the cast is pretty good, but visually, it looks terrible.
Yeah, Benedict Cumberbatch as a tiger might be cool, but yeah, the animation is abysmal.
Second trailer.
Deadly Class is a sci-fi original series. No, wait, it's called an original series, but I think it's based on a graphic novel about a school where they train kids to kill people? I'm not really sure. I mean, there's a lot of violence in this trailer, and there's a lot of cigarette smoking. It stars Lana Condor, who was in the deleted scenes of the last X-Men movie as Jubilee, and was also in the hit Netflix movie To All the Boys. I'd like to point out that she is a cute Asian girl, and I say that for a specific reason, because this show is clearly anti-PC, it's clearly science fiction, it stars a cute Asian girl, but I'm not with it. And the reason I'm not with it, and this is the problem I'm having now, is There doesn't seem to be any depth to this. Why is this story being told? I really wish more people would ask, why are we telling this story, besides, as we were saying with social media earlier, to get ratings, to make a buck. Tell a story to tell a good story. What is the purpose? What is the theme you were trying to communicate? Ultimately, the purpose of storytelling is to tell a theme, tell an idea that you could only tell in this form. I don't know what idea this is. I don't know what it is. I like all of these concretes, but I don't know what this adds up to. So I'm sorry, Lana Condor. I'll wait for the sequel for To All the Boys. Tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, I didn't know quite what to do with this. Tackle.
Tackle.
Yeah, I really wanted to hear William's opinion on this, because he's always complaining about there not being good sci-fi. So I try to throw in sci-fi stuff for him.
Yeah, it doesn't... I mean, I guess it is kind of sci-fi, but where's the sci? You know, a little too much fi, not enough sci. In this case, maybe literal size, but not actual science.
Third trailer.
Avengers Endgame is the follow-up to Avengers Infinity War, where Thanos killed half of the planet with the snap of a finger. This trailer starts out just as Avengers Infinity War did. It starts out with Tony Stark utterly stealing the stage, stealing the movie, stealing the trailer, and it's actually shot and stylized in the beginning. But then as the trailer goes on and continues, and they introduce Captain America, and then finally Ant-Man, and basically traces the progression of the way the Marvel Cinematic Universe has progressed, it gets exceedingly worse. But here's the thing. I love what they did in the beginning, and I just want to see what happens. So is this a particularly good trailer? It's the trailer they had to make. They are intentionally leading with Iron Man. They are intentionally tracing the progression this way. They did that with Infinity War on purpose. They're doing it here intentionally. It's the trailer they had to make because they don't want to reveal too much, but they want to tease how they're going to get out of what Thanos did. So this is the only trailer there could have been. Is it good or bad? Doesn't matter. It's going to make a shitload of money. I'm going to see it. Hug. Daniel.
That went one direction and then took a hard turn. I've still not seen the...
Right? It's like McDonald's, okay? Does McDonald's make good food? No.
No.
Do I get excited to eat it? No. Is it within walking distance of my apartment? Yes. Am I going to eat it? Yes. Hug.
Hug.
Fair enough. I haven't still been seeing the first Avengers with Thanos, so I kind of do know what happens because of, you know, everything. But I don't really think I'm gonna see it. I'll say the opening scene was very touching, and I got a little emotional during it.
Because why? Because it's Tony Stark.
Yes, indeed. Tony Stark is fantastic. Robert Downey Jr. is fantastic, etc. But I don't know. I'm not all that interested. And anytime Captain America comes on screen, I just want to throw up. So, tackle.
Final trailer.
Brightburn is James Gunn's horror version of Man of Steel. I say that very intentionally because if you have watched this trailer, you see that the entire first half of the trailer is completely a reference to, intentionally, very intentionally, even the font's almost exactly the same, the Man of Steel trailer. So I think there's a few things to talk about here. The first thing is, I don't hate James Gunn, okay? I think he has decent concepts. I like horror. So let's just get out of the way before we talk about all of the other cultural stuff that's going on with this trailer. Let's just get out of the way that this is legitimately a hug for me.
Hug.
I don't see this movie. The idea that, hey, I'm going to take the Superman mythos and flip it on its head is interesting to me. So that's the first thing, is like watching the trailer is worth talking about on its own. The first half, realizing it had to be intentional and then seeing it flipped on its head and the way they did that and with the cast, I enjoyed watching this trailer. So Daniel, let's talk about that first. You?
Yes. Yeah, I thought it was super interesting. It starts to go off the rails a little bit to me when it becomes too horror-y. This is a movie, to me, that is perfectly done in a sci-fi way that you don't need the horror element to it. Or maybe you could have just a tinge of it, but the trailer hits you really hard over the head with the horror stuff at the end, especially the way they start cutting the scenes and the way the music changes and the way the aesthetic changes, etc. And that, to me personally, that is just a sense of life thing. I'm immediately turned off from that. When I was totally in with just the science fiction question of this and just the really simple inversion of the Superman story where instead of this kid growing up to be exceptional and good, he grows up to be exceptional and bad. That's interesting enough. Why throw a horror layer on top of it? I don't need that in my life. So, I don't know. I'm conflicted. Convince me.
Okay. Well, the best argument I can use is, first of all, I will concede to you the worst part about the trailer was at the end when it seemed like he became a slasher. And
yeah.
I think that is where the critique is, not with horror. Because to me, if you have a superpowered person and he can be exceptionally good or exceptionally bad, if he becomes exceptionally bad, if he chooses to be exceptionally bad, right? Let's assume it's romanticism, because James Gunn doesn't really make naturalism. Let's assume it's romanticism. Yeah. If he chooses to become exceptionally bad, that has to be a horror movie. Now, we unfortunately have this conflation nowadays where horror means slasher, and it seems that Gunn may go in that direction, and I may watch this movie and be disappointed because that final shot where it's like, where are they, in like the back of a restaurant or in a refrigerator, and the kid's wearing the mask?
Yeah, something like that.
That was definitely the worst shot of the trailer. But I don't want you to conflate horror with slasher. And if Gunn goes in that direction, it speaks to his weakness as a filmmaker. But I think it's worth giving him a chance to see what he does with this, because to have the balls to do what they did in the trailer and make this kind of movie speaks volumes, because he could have done a lot with his clout that he got from Guardians of the Galaxy and working from Disney with Disney, and this is what he decided to do with it.
Well, he could have done a lot with his clout until all those tweets surfaced, and then this is what he had to do, I think. But I do agree that the beginning of this and the conceit of it is super interesting and innovative, and if it was just that and it cut for the end scene, it would be a total hug, unequivocal. But because of that last scene, I will give it a questioned, tentative hug instead.
Hug.
Fair enough. But let's discuss more the couple layers of culture we have here. The first layer is that this is James Gunn making a movie that's essentially supposed to be like a what if also told story of Man of Steel. At least that's how it's being marketed. What makes that really interesting is most people may not realize this. James Gunn wrote Zack Snyder's first movie, Man of Steel. Oh, no, sorry. That was really dumb.
Careful.
James Gunn wrote Zack Snyder's first movie, Dawn of the Dead, which was a horror movie. Now we see Zack Snyder's version, Man of Steel, done without James Gunn, and James Gunn version, Brightburn, done without Zack Snyder. So the fact that these two things exist culturally, and there's such a negative backlash for Zack Snyder, but not for James Gunn when he makes the collectivistic, second-handed Guardians of the Galaxy, is interesting. And I think that being able to have these two movies, once Brightburn is out and we've seen it, will give us the ability to go, okay, watch these two movies and you decide who's the better filmmaker and who's the benevolent human being.
That is an interesting point, and one that makes this movie worth seeing just for that.
Good. Mid-siders. I didn't even intend it as an argument, but there you go. So I think maybe we'll do a mid-side exclusive, Patreon exclusive review of Brightburn. I think that would be worth it. But then there's the other thing, right? The Snyder fans out there, the release, the Snyder cut people on Twitter and everything, I think are aware of this sort of comparison and how this sort of moment is important. So then they're out there trying to defend Zack Snyder, but they do it in a way that alienates me completely, who I want to be their ally. I want to be on their side. So there was a tweet, and of course I was dumb and responded to it, and I've been attacked on Twitter ever since. There was a tweet responding to this trailer. It says, Man of Steel, what if Superman's journey was analogous to the post-9/11 immigrant experience and he had to make much harder decisions about the use of his power? Internet, betrayal. Brightburn, what if Superman was just like fucking evil? Internet, brilliant. So I replied to this and I said, if Man of Steel were really about the post-9/11 immigrant experience, to be fair, I would rather watch Brightburn. It pisses me off to no end that people are trying to reinterpret Man of Steel in this way. Look, there are valid observations about Batman versus Superman involved with immigration, right? He goes down to Mexico and there's that whole scene where all the Mexicans are surrounding him. There's this whole thing about this is my world, you are my world. There's things about immigration in that movie. In Man of Steel, there's nothing except for the fact that he is an immigrant. Yes, he's an alien. He's from another planet. But the whole movie is based on his abilities and how his abilities make him different from people and make him an outsider. And then when he discovers where he's from, what does his dad talk about? Does his dad talk about being different and how you have to learn to be okay with yourself even though you're different? No, the dad tells him a story of a collectivist society and how he's individualistic and how he came to Earth to show people how to be individualistic. How is that a story of immigration? Is that what we're saying the essentials of immigrants are? That they're coming to America to teach us how to be individualistic? No, that story's been told. Go watch Crazy Rich Asians, how the old world is trying to make us be collectivistic, and their hatred is for the individualistic Americans. They tell that story. That's the best modern retelling of the old world, new world story, Crazy Rich Asians. This is not what Man of Steel is about. It's never been about that. And it pisses me off that people are out there reinterpreting it that way. And then they use these Foucault-type techniques to try and say that people like me are crazy for not seeing it that way.
You're here. I don't have anything to add to that.
Well, why do you think they're interpreting it this way? They say, oh, well, Snyder said it's an immigrant story. And Snyder pointed out that the people who made Superman were immigrants. Look, no one's saying that he's not an immigrant. He is technically an immigrant. He's an alien. But that is, when you read a story, you have to essentialize it. That's not the essential of the story.
Yeah. It's like saying Atlas Shrugged is a book about trains.
100%. And I was trying to come up with examples, and that's a perfect example.
Yeah.
It's like, so how about this? It's like saying Die Hard is a movie about a cop.
Right.
It's not, he happens to be a cop, yes, but what it's a movie is about an American fighting for his values. That is what Die Hard is about. It's about Americanism.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is just very standard Marxist critical theory, which is art is only useful insofar as it pushes along an oppressor-oppressed story, and it's not useful insofar as it doesn't. So Marxist critical theory teaches people to read into stories oppressor-oppressor relationships, even if those aren't actually there. You're just finding, instead, it's a primacy of consciousness tactic, where instead of looking at the evidence and drawing a conclusion from it, you are applying a theory to the evidence and making it fit. So in this case, they're just reading onto Man of Steel a post 9/11 immigrant story that isn't there, because they can pull out super, super small concretes to make them seem like they are right. This is just what the schools have done to our children's brains, Justin.
I know, and it annoys me so much. I didn't even touch the post 9/11 thing, because that's just like a buzzword. There's not even any post 9/11 stuff in there. In fact, the movie is arguably a retelling of 9/11 with the ending, if you're going to go that route. But here's the other thing that really bothers me about all this. This Marxist critical lens to Zack Snyder movies, in defense of Zack Snyder movies. If you look at all of his movies, including Batman versus Superman, doesn't he go out of his way to blow up the oppressor-oppressed narrative? I mean, if you look at 300, isn't that the entire point? That the Persians are trying to oppress the Spartans? And then if you look at Sucker Punch, isn't it how to find your individuality and live for your freedom and fight for your freedom, even though people are trying to oppress you? And then you look at Batman versus Superman. Isn't Lex the villain because he's trying to make Batman believe one of them is the oppressor and one of them is the oppressed, but true justice is to treat people as individuals?
Seems like there's a theme here.
And that's the irony, and this is why it makes me so mad. Aren't they wildly missing what Zack Snyder is all about in order to try and defend Zack Snyder?
Yeah. It's because the cultural Marxism is above all. Like, it doesn't matter if they like Zack Snyder or they like anyone. The Marxism takes precedence over everyone and everything, because we must find oppressed relationships. The end.
And I'm going to be really honest here right now. You know what scares me the most? The thought of one day talking to Zack Snyder and then he goes, yeah, all those people are right and you're the crazy one.
No.
Because then I doing what they're doing and I'm just reading all this shit into his movies?
I thought you were going to say spiders.
This is like the psychological spider, okay? This is the psychological equivalent of a spider.
Look, you could meet Zack Snyder and that could happen. And it would be a massive, massive, massive failure of reading of something. But it would also mean that he is acting contrary to all the evidence. Like, that the meaning in his mind is contrary to all the available evidence. Not just the evidence in the films themselves, which you must take as their own universes, but evidence outside. Like when he says, quote, I have an Ayn Rand aesthetic, end quote. And he's read the Romantic Manifesto, for instance. Like, okay, if that's true and you meet him someday and he says, nope, I'm really, you know, this is a Marxist thing that I'm applying to all my whatevers. Either he is backwards rationalizing because he's ashamed of what he did.
Well, because of what happened in Justice League, it's PTSD, right?
PTSD, or, you know, he is just honestly acting contrary to what his values are.
Right, and that's what I remember in my head. Either he is accidentally the greatest filmmaker of all time, right? Either he somehow accidentally made all of these great movies, or he is making The Fountainhead as his next movie.
Right. So, yeah, of course it could be, but the evidence suggests otherwise.
All right, that rant out of the way. Let's talk about some other things that have perpetuated in our culture and become a meme, sort of like Basic, or sort of like, what was the other one we were talking about? Oh, Hot Take. Well, let's talk about some other slang words in Life on the Midside. Take a good look around. Does life really suck? Are we just complaining? I hope that this mic is on. Because I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. So, Daniel, I don't know how caught up you are on the Adam and Drew show, but they, for basically a week, talked about the phrase, speak your truth. Did you hear any of those episodes?
I don't think I did. That might be how far behind I am.
Yeah, you're behind by a couple weeks then. And it's interesting because they made fun of it pretty well. They made fun of it pretty well, but they didn't get to the root explanation of where speak your truth came from. You know, the dangerous part of speak your truth is it reduces truth to subjectivism, where it's speak your truth because your truth is different than everyone else's truth. Agree or disagree?
Agree, with the added layer that it is particularly dangerous because it's not speak your mind or speak your opinion or, you know, speak your experience. It's speak your truth. Truth is something that is inviolate. Truth is something that people either metaphorically or sometimes literally go to war for. And it's putting it in the end of each individual that they have their own truth. Thus, when I speak my truth and someone contradicts me, they are contradicting something that is inviolate, that is violence against me, because they are, you know, destroying my truth. So I think it's particularly dangerous for those reasons.
Okay, I agree with everything you said completely, which is why at a certain point I had to get to the root of where this slang came from. And actually, it has a semi-rational connected to reality. And I call it semi-rational because it's connected to reality. Origin. Yes, thank you. I was trying to come up with that word. The reason is I tutor. And in my tutoring, one of my students, who's particularly bright, started talking to me about how her teacher did a whole session on slang and the importance of slang and what it means and blah, blah, blah. And one of them was the phrase, spill the tea. Have you ever heard this phrase before, Daniel? Spill the tea.
Never once.
Okay, well, this is very popular with the MTV generation, with reality TV. Spilling the tea is where you share information about somebody that will expose something about them. It's like, oh, well, I'm going to spill the tea on when those two hooked up and nobody wanted to know about it. Or, oh, they don't want to talk about the fight they had, so I'm going to spill the tea on what happened with that.
Why tea?
Okay, well, that is what I wondered.
Oh, truth? For truth?
Ah, see? You made the leap I could never make. I was like, are we pretending to be British? Like, I was like, is this like we're old British ladies? Like, oh, it's tea and crumpets. Let's spill the tea because you've upset me by revealing some secret during our tea and crumpet session. Like, that's what
you know,
I thought.
Only reason I got this is I recently talked to someone about the South Park episode, "There, Here Comes the Neighborhood," where they want to burn lowercase t's in their lawn for time to leave.
Oh, I thought it because I'm linking it with speak your truth.
Oh, no, not at all. Got it because I was thinking of strange relationships with the sound T.
Yeah, well, you're 100% correct. But now this goes even deeper because you want to know where this idea of your tea comes from. So if someone's spilling the tea, they're spilling your tea, which is your truth. This comes from the transgender community. This comes from drag, where if you tell that somebody else is actually a dude that's dressed like a girl, you're spilling the tea.
Oh, in that case, it sounds like you were spilling the D.
or the testosterone.
Oh, spilling come on, the that tea. Deserved.
But it means, it literally means truth. You're spilling the truth. It's sort of like the idea that it's not right for you to reveal if somebody else is gay. It's sort of like that. Mm-hmm. It's not right for you to reveal that somebody else is actually transgender or cross-dressing or whatever terminology you want to say.
Right.
So this is my question, right? Because this is semi-rational, right? Now, I'm not defending transgenderism or whatever. I'm not making a statement on that. But I'm saying you can understand where this slang comes from, you know, spilling the tea. That's connected to reality. There is a legitimate tea. And then that is your truth. If you're saying speak your truth, you're saying, well, I'm actually a dude. So speaking your truth is valid in that sense. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Right? It's, if it's in that limited sense of like, oh, by the way, my truth is that I actually have Crohn's disease and I haven't told any of you. Or I've been dying of cancer for the past 2 years. Like, that is speaking your truth. It's a little truth in reality that's immutable. But the problem is, why do we, as heterosexual, heteronormative culture, continue to take these slang terms from gay, transgender, sexually whatever, deviant, if you want to call it that, sexually different, you know, gay, transgender, sexually different. Why do we continue to take our slang terms from these cultures and apply them to a heteronormative culture? And then when we do, we're obviously misapplying them because we're losing the cultural context in translation. Throwing the shade is another one, when you throw shade at someone. Like, we all speak like passive-aggressive women. You've heard of throwing shade, yes?
I've heard the phrase. I didn't know it was a woman thing.
Yeah, it comes from, like, Drag Race, like RuPaul's Drag Race and all of that. That's where I first heard of it.
Is it that we, you know, to use a phrase from the social justice warriors, is it that we're essentially just bad cultural appropriators, and that we just take culture that we find useful and we appropriate it for our own ends and sort of drop the cultural context? Or do you think there's something else going on here that's, I don't know, more or less devious? I'm not sure where you're going yet.
I think there's something more going on here, and I'm trying to figure out what it is, basically. I think it has to do with the normalization of things. That would be my first guess at it. And it's the idea that, you know, it's part of the whole queer eye for the straight guy thing, right?
Yeah.
The idea that they all know better about fashion than straight guys, and that, you know, women know better about aesthetics than straight guys. We're supposed to not have these gender norms, and we're supposed to blow up all of these categories, and but collectivistically, straight white men are retarded at everything. And I think
you said it.
I said it, yeah. Get that drop. Straight white men are retarded at everything. But for some reason, we've decided to take these phrases and things from this culture, where it has a valid use in their culture. I'm not, like, if somebody had explained that to me in the beginning, I would say, oh yeah, that makes sense. And I wouldn't hate it. But it's the same reason I hate the word basic. You're using it and you're, what is it? Is it from Atlas Shrugged? You continue to use that word, but I don't think you know what that word means. That's not Atlas Shrugged. What is that?
That's not Atlas Shrugged. Is that the Princess Bride?
That might be the Princess Bride. Okay, you get the point I'm making. Words have meanings. You continue to use
best
that
mix
word,
up in the history
you know
of the midside.
Means.
Yeah. Right, like how in white culture we say, you know, speak your T-bill, because we all have investments and so much money. And if that was used outside of our white culture, no one would. Like, it'd be inappropriate, because they wouldn't get it.
Sure.
Okay. That was hilarious. Okay. I did have a point. The point was this. I think there's really nothing going on here more than a sort of raising of feminine culture overall, femininity over masculinity overall in the past, you know, two decades or so. You know, what Adam Kroll identified when he wrote the book, In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks, and he said the only thing he got wrong in that entire book is that it was more like 15 years and not 50, which is simply that the cultural things that are taking on now are the cultural things that would have been considered feminine 20 or 25 years ago. And I think that's it. I mean, I don't think there's anything per se devious about it. I think there's something overall detrimental about it, but I don't think people are doing it necessarily other than to be in what is considered culturally acceptable. And that's about it.
Yeah, and that's
my overarching thought.
Yeah, that's probably why it upsets me as a dude, right? And as I've gotten older, getting more in touch with my masculinity and being more comfortable with my own masculinity and seeing the ways that I had that femininity put into me and it made me suffer. And I mean that, I don't mean being feminine can make you suffer if that's the way you are naturally. I am not naturally feminine, so trying to be that way caused me psychological anguish. And I think that's why it makes me angry, because you're right. Even when I talked about spilling the tea, when I tried to figure out what it was, notice how I pictured British ladies sitting around saying it. Just like three clones of Queen Elizabeth. That's what I pictured. I didn't picture British dudes, because do dudes spill the tea?
I don't think so.
No, we don't have time for that. Do we care? Do we care? No, we don't care. We just fucking do the shit we need to do. And do dudes speak your truth? No, we speak the truth. We don't care. Yeah. Speaking the truth is a very feminine thing. So I think you're right. I think that's why it ultimately bothers me. And that's why it's dangerous. We need a balance between these things.
Yeah, absolutely. A yin and a yang, if you will. Or a yin and a wang? Okay.
We got to figure out a way to make yin similar to vagina. Because that's pretty good. Something in wang is pretty good. We need to come up with that. Midsiders out there, maybe you can come up with a phrase there, because I like that.
Never mind. I've got things, but I can't say them on air anymore.
All right. So. Well, you can feed them to me later, and I'll say them on air.
Okay. There you go.
Really, honestly, everyone out there, just so you know, that this entire podcast is Daniel. It's just he scripts it all, and then the shit he doesn't want to say, he's like, Justin, can you do this?
That's right.
I'm just a patsy. I'm sorry, guys.
If only.
All right. What did we learn this trip, Daniel?
Well, I certainly learned what the heck spilled the tea was, and that it wasn't actual drinking tea. So that was interesting. Justin, what did you learn?
As I said, Daniel, I thought it was tea for so long, too. And I was like, why in this alcohol-obsessed culture are you all talking about tea constantly? And then they mime. If you ever watch like an MTV reality show, they mime sipping tea when tea's being spilled, and I'm like, why are we obsessed with this caffeinated beverage, and why is no one eating crumpets?
America's a coffee country, damn it.
That was part of what I was thinking.
That's so, right.
That's funny. I learned about the increasing battle, or another front of the battle between masculinity and femininity, and that I really wish it wouldn't be a battle. I wish we could find that balance, because I know so often on this show we come out as pro-masculine, but that's because we're dudes, if you haven't noticed. So of course we want to defend masculinity, but we also love femininity because we're dudes, so we love women. So I just...
Well, at least the two of us.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do a microaggression against William, the queer, the fag.
That's a macroaggression.
Oh, we love you.
If he was here right now, he would be legally allowed to beat you with his shoe. That's in the law. Look it up. Google it.
I just wish we had that balance. That's all. Can we just find the balance, please? This is the midside. We're all about balance. We're all about the something in the wang, and the something is Daniel's going to tell me it.
The something and the wang. That is a catchphrase. All right. Well, if you enjoyed today's show, please like us on all the social medias or follow us or whatever it is the action is these days. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, etc. And help us spread the word about the show. Subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And thanks to Liberty.me for getting us out there. We love you, libertarians. TheMidSide.com/store has all your favorite merch for the holiday season, including a False Dichotomy Bro shirt, which makes a perfect stocking stuffer. And then, of course, you can leave reviews on all those sites as well. Patreon.com/TheMidSide, mentioned that earlier, but that helps us keep the lights on. And then finally, the most important thing you can do this holiday season is tell a friend about the show. Just sit them down for a moment and say, we have something to tell you. I have this great podcast that you're going to want to listen to. And they're going to be so relieved it isn't cancer that they're going to listen. So do that. It'd be awesome. Listen to with your family and friends over the holiday season, and you could get some free Midside swag as long as you record yourselves listening to Welcome to the Midside. And yeah, until next time, we love you.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Amosneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day. Still a little trouble there with your name.
I think I'm going to write a book called The Something and the Wang.
Yeah, I can't wait for the sequel to that.
That'll by the way, awesome. I kind of messed up my name a little bit on purpose.
Oh, I'm Zessie? And you're the one who doesn't drink alcohol.